This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, a special statehood anniversary show. We'll take a look at the forces that helped move Alaska toward statehood and some of the opposition. Plus, how a popular novel aided statehood efforts and memories of an early Kenai Peninsula homesteader.
The whole forest by this time looked like the back door to hell. It was all standing, all very blackened.
That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Steve Heimel.
My late husband, my then 2-year-old son, and I were at the bonfire.
I remember the day that Mike Gravel's wife climbed a ladder to pin the star on the American flag that represented statehood for Alaska.
The headline "We're In" has become the iconic symbol of statehood. I set the type for that headline.
The pride that we felt that day was incredible.
It was a tremendously exciting time.
Many Alaskans can remember when they learned Alaska would become a state. It was June 1958 when the U.S. Senate passed an Alaska statehood bill. This week, we begin our series on the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood with a look at the forces that propelled Alaska to become the 49th state. Hawaii was sure it would be 49th. In fact, one person we interviewed remembered being in Hawaii for a 49th state celebration. Retired Air Force General Jim Keck was in Hawaii from 1952 to 55.
They had a state fair, and they called it the 49th State Fair, and that's what I remember. It was in 1952. I mean, they were planning ahead.
But Alaska beat it to the punch. It took a lot of effort. The territorial legislature first introduced a statehood bill in 1915. The first Alaska statehood club was organized in Valdez the following year. In 1916, Judge James Wickersham, delegate to the U.S. Congress, introduced a statehood bill, but it went nowhere, in part because Alaskans weren't yet behind it. That started to change by the 1940s. The territory's population was growing due largely to World War II. Groups like the Alaska Statehood Committee and Operation Statehood formed to lobby Congress. Hearings were held, and by 1955, the majority of Alaskans favored statehood. That's when Alaska elected delegates for a constitutional convention to write the state's governing document and show the nation what kind of state they wanted to be. The convention met in Fairbanks, and every day, for months, the delegates researched issues, debated, wrote passages, revised, and refined the language. They were spurred on by remarks from former territorial governor Ernest Greening.
We meet to validate the most basic of American principles. Principle of government by consent of the governed. We take this historic step because the people of Alaska who have elected you have come to see that their long-standing and unceasing protests against the restrictions, discriminations, and exclusions to which we are subject have been unheeded by the colonialism that has ruled Alaska for 88 years.
Alaskans were proud of the results of the convention. The Constitution was overwhelmingly approved in 1956. The path to statehood then followed what they called the Tennessee Plan, electing a delegation to Congress, Representative Ralph Rivers and Senators Ernest Greening and William Egan. They had no official role in Washington, D.C., but they became Alaska's biggest statehood advocates. There were plenty of issues that got Alaskans fired up about statehood. Not being able to vote for president, discrimination in transportation law. But the overwhelming argument was that Alaska's rich resources were being exploited for the good of private companies, not the country, the state, or Alaskans themselves. At the time, fish held the top spot in Alaska's economy. In fact, 80% of territorial revenues after World War II were derived from fishing. But most of the profits from this quintessential Alaskan industry were heading south into the pockets of Seattle cannery owners. Particularly galling to Alaskans were the giant fish traps the canneries set up at the mouths of rivers to scoop up the harvest, thus preempting local fishermen. The practice deepened a long simmering resentment toward outside interests, and it served as a powerful political tool for boosters of Alaska's independence. Ann Sutton looks at how Alaskans yearning for local control of their resources played into the long push toward statehood.
They call Petersburg the town that fish built. Settled by Norwegian fishermen more than a century ago, it's a tidy, discreetly prosperous-looking place. The homes are trim, the gardens carefully tended, and the fishing fleet, well, lifelong resident John Inge considers it the finest in the state.
They're so clean and so nice and so kept up, and you just got to be proud of this fleet in Petersburg, which has made Petersburg as the fleet. It isn't the canneries, it isn't that, it's the fishermen that made the town.
In his 93 years, Inge's seen the town's fishing fortunes ebb and flow. In the 1950s, he managed a small cannery called the Kalerdal Fish Plant, now Ocean Beauty. Kalerdal bought its fish from the local fleet, but the larger canneries, owned by Seattle companies, got theirs by parking long and efficient wire traps across many of the best fishing waters. That didn't endear them to local fishermen, who sometimes robbed the traps for easy pickings and sometimes went to jail for it. Folks in town would deadpan that they'd gone to college. A few fishermen were in the slammer when Polly Lee arrived as a young bride.
The shenanigans that took place at the fish traps, you can imagine with humans, all the things they can think of to do to thwart a law they don't like if it's robbing them of their livelihood.
Lee's late husband, a fisherman named Elder Lee, also chafed under the federal laws that allowed fish traps to operate in Alaska long after they'd been banned in Washington State, Oregon, and British Columbia. But instead of resorting to thievery, Lee got himself elected to the 1955 Constitutional Convention.
He saw this as an opportunity to do his part and help to make a constitution for the state of Alaska and have state control and get rid of federal control of a lot of our resources.
Statehood boosters used fish traps to plumb a deep well of resentment. In his opening speech to the convention, former territorial governor Ernest Greening singled out the traps as symbols of the injustice of what he called colonial rule.
Colonialism has preferred to preserve the power and perquisites of a distant bureaucracy and the control and special privileges, the fish traps, of a politically potent absentee industry. Alaska has been the victim, but the entire nation has also lost heavily.
Tough words directed at the largest economic engine in the state, but those same words could have been aimed at the fur trade, mining, or some might argue oil at other points in Alaska's history. Statehood's nemesis in the early part of the century was the Alaska Syndicate, under J.P. Morgan and the Guggenheims. It owned the giant Kennecott Copper Mine and controlled steamship and rail transportation in the territory. Alaska Judge James Wickersham railed against its iron grip, but his efforts to promote home rule were quashed by the syndicate's Washington lobby, says David Stone, author of A History of Mining in Alaska.
They wanted free rein. They didn't want to be saddled with additional laws and taxation and all those issues naturally that comes with us becoming a state. And that was a pretty powerful force.
By wartime, the big mines were either played out or closed, but timber looked like an up-and-coming player. The industry didn't support statehood, but it also didn't put up a fight, says University of Alaska history professor Stephen Haycox. That's because by 1947, Congress had authorized the U.S. Forest Service to conduct timber lease sales on the Tongass National Forest and develop 50-year contracts for up to 5 pulp mills to be built.
So that economy was guaranteed. It wasn't going to affect them, and it didn't affect them at all. And by the time of statehood, one pulp mill had already been constructed, Ketchikan, and the second one was under construction, Sitka.
Explorers struck oil on the Kenai Peninsula in 1957, and some believe it was the Swanson River discovery that may have swayed some opponents in Congress to vote for statehood. Haycock says oil companies eager to explore the North Slope may have favored home rule because the state, unlike the federal government, could institute competitive bidding on lease sales.
If it's competitive bidding, the tracts are larger, and whoever the company is can bid on a whole series of adjacent tracts all at once. So in the long run, it makes it much more efficient and perhaps cheaper for the industry.
But oil was still in its infancy at the time of the convention. Then fisheries were the dominant resource, and delegates were spurred by a sense of urgency. Salmon stocks had plummeted through the 1940s and 50s, largely the result of cumbersome federal management. Former Dillingham-based reporter Bob King, who's studied the history of state fisheries, says an effort to tighten the limits during a particular Bristol Bay opening demonstrated just how rigid the system was.
And, of course, they have to send this measure back to Washington, D.C., and it has to be debated in Congress, and it has to be published in the Federal Register. And by the time the fishing time is actually reduced, it was the end of July when the salmon run was over.
In writing the Constitution, the delegates added key provisions for sustaining Alaska fisheries to a section on natural resource development. They also wanted to show Congress that statehood had the rousing support of Alaskans, so they added a measure banning fish traps to the election ratifying the Constitution. Bob King.
This was intended to draw people to the polls, and it worked. It worked overwhelmingly. The Alaska Constitutional passed by an easy margin, by a 2-to-1 margin among the state. The ordinance to ban fish traps passed 5-to-1. I think that really demonstrates what the role of fish traps, and the idea of local control meant to Alaskans at that time.
The Petersburg Purse Seine fleet is in, and that means the canneries are up and running. Workers dressed in yellow slickers are elbow-deep in fish guts and slime. Many canneries went broke after fish traps were banned at statehood. Those that hung on saw salmon stocks eventually rebuild, and annual seafood production grow from 300 million pounds at statehood to 5.3 billion pounds today. A lot of money still goes south, but plenty stays. In Petersburg, you can see it in the roads and schools, the tidy homes and well-kept boats. John Enge believes Alaskans did the right thing 50 years ago.
All these big shots like Guggenheim and all these guys running the canneries living in the States, we had to get rid of them. We didn't want all that money to leave Alaska.
For AK, I'm Ann Sutton.
Coming up after the break, the role of the military and veterans in building momentum toward statehood.
It was just the place to be. You know, Alaska has everything that a veteran likes, hunting and fishing, independence, outdoor activities.
Stay with us. Welcome back to AK. If you ask older Alaskans how they came to the state, many might have a story something like this.
I was a reluctant Alaskan. I went through processing in the Army 12 different times, and they asked my choice of overseas assignment, and I told them any place but Alaska.
Lee Jordan was only 17 when he was assigned to the Army's Alaska Communication Service, the ACS. He arrived by troop ship in Whittier on a cold January day in 1949.
Got off the ship about 9 o'clock in the morning, and they lined us up alongside the railroad track there in Whittier, and we stood there for about 2 hours. We got onto a Alaska Railroad car, and that trip took us. We finally got underway about 2 o'clock. We got into Anchorage at midnight. It was a very long trip, and I asked somebody how long, what the distance was, and they said only 40 miles, and I was quite surprised that it took that long to get there. We were unloaded out at Fort Richardson. That was before Elmendorf was anything but an Army airfield, and they unloaded us in a what we call tent city. It was plywood bottoms with canvas tent tops, and the each one had an oil space heater, and the space heater in our tent didn't work. Got to the ACS people, there were four of us, and brand new Chevrolet staff car pulled up, and I thought, well, this is just like the Army, you know, they need a dog team, but they send a staff car. So we went out Post Road and got up to 4th Avenue, and that was the most pleasant surprise I've ever had, to see all those real buildings and real houses and real civilization. So, no, it was not the primitive area that I had expected, but a regular town.
Jordan had a room in a house and worked in the federal building on 4th Avenue. He ate dinner every night at a certain restaurant and ended up marrying his favorite waitress, a young lady who had been here with her family for 10 years already. So by the time he left the Army in 1954, Alaska was home, and there was no question of leaving. He says that was true for many of his colleagues.
A lot of the people that I work with, their entire career in the Army had been with ACS, and they got out, as I did, and stayed in the area. Everybody who was serving back then and in World War II were taken with the lifestyle in Alaska, the opportunities. Homesteads were still available at that time, and a lot of the veterans were able to homestead and get land and establish homes. Yeah, it was just the place to be.
Jordan worked as a typesetter for the Anchorage Times. He's the guy that set the "We're In" headline proclaiming to Alaskans that statehood had passed. He and his family opened up their own print shop in Eagle River and founded the Chugiak Eagle River Star newspaper, now the Alaska Star, which they ran for 30 years. So many of the soldiers stayed that by 1950, the census showed a population of 150,000 in the territory, more than double what it was in 1940. Lee Jordan was one of many who settled here and built the state's infrastructure, from telecommunications to roads and ports. Alaska became a much more developed place. Over the years leading up to statehood, the nation's defense needs repeatedly brought in waves of military spending. But there were also big troughs between those waves. For instance, when World War II ended in the fall of 1945, the military quickly shut down most of its activities here. By the end of 1946, there were only about 19,000 military personnel in Alaska, compared to a peak of 150,000 during the war. But the next year, fears began building about the Soviet Union. The term Cold War came into use. The Air Force began beefing up, and Army Chief of Staff Dwight Eisenhower paid a visit and advocated for Alaska's importance as a defense location. In 1949, the Soviet Union tested its own atomic bomb. In 1952, Eisenhower was elected president. Eisenhower was serious about the strategic importance of Alaska. Once elected president, he advocated for statehood for Hawaii, but not Alaska. It's said that language allowing the entire northern half of the state to be turned into a military reservation by presidential order was inserted in the Statehood Act to satisfy his concerns. There were also partisan reasons for Eisenhower to favor Hawaii over Alaska. It was Republican, while Alaska was Democratic. The Democrats already had a slight edge in the Senate. But military historian John Klo thinks Eisenhower's objection to statehood for Alaska was economic. He thought the state didn't have enough of an economy to support itself. What would happen the next time the military decided to pull out? Klo was the historian of Elmendorf Air Force Base for more than 30 years.
To reach a target in the lower 48, or the continental states, what they were probably called at that time, a Russian bomber would have to fly over Alaska to get there. So we had a massive construction of radar and air defense systems. You know, the Dew Line was built across Alaska and Canada. An aircraft control and warning system was built in Alaska with coastal sites, interior sites. And I think at the height of it, was like 23 radar stations, 6 fighter interceptor squadrons, about 27,000 Air Force personnel in the state. It had reached the height in 1957. Massive buildup. You know, like $1.2 billion was spent. in the state. The military became the mainstay of the economy with all of this construction going on all over the state, plus people going downtown buying stuff and you know, that normal presence there. And it sort of peaked in 1957 and then declined because the military started a massive reduction in forces following the launch of Sputnik. The economic situation really didn't improve until the earthquake came along in 64. And the military by that time was in a retrenchment. Vietnam was going on. They're sending forces elsewhere, very major reductions. The military didn't really start coming back in its own until the early 80s. And, of course, you see a lot of construction going on now, this basing of forces here. And the primary advantage the military enjoyed up here is it's a strategic location. They can get to Europe quicker. They can get to the Far East quicker. And the military will probably be here for a long time. I'm sure there are going to be some more reductions in the future. You know, hopefully the war on terrorism will one day end.
You barely mentioned Eisenhower. And I find that interesting because Eisenhower was the president at the time the Statehood Act was passed. What I'm wondering is about, because Eisenhower was so pivotal in statehood, it was not until Eisenhower's objections were removed that statehood could really get through the Congress, because it was, things were tied up in the Congress over the civil rights. But because Eisenhower had this strategic objection, well, at least that's the way the history has been written, there was a problem there.
He came up and visited Alaska, I think, in the 47 time frame. And I think he looked around and he realized we needed to build up a military up here. I think his opposition to statehood is fairly well known. I think it was based on the concerns that can Alaska pay its way? You know, the federal government has been providing all these services, and all of a sudden Alaska is going to have to provide it for himself. Do they have a foundation to do it with? And I think that was a major opposition. He's also concerned about the defense of the state. And I guess somebody has talked about the so-called Eisenhower line. They drew an arbitrary line of defense that protected through about the middle of Alaska. It came from north down south, and I can't remember exact the locations of it. And basically, the military said that we can defend the main bases, we can defend the main population centers, but we can't defend places like Nome and Kotzebue. They're too far out. And, of course, I think Nome Nugget had an editorial, but I remember reading it. They were very upset about being left out to an invasion of the Soviet Union. The line never went anywhere. It sort of became a relic after a number of years. The military switched its tactics, defending far forward as possible.
Was there a military argument against statehood?
Somebody's mentioned that before, and I've been spent 32 years of my life writing military history of Alaska, and I've read a great deal about Alaska, and I've yet to come across any source. I mean, I'll be glad to. I wish somebody would point out who said it. You know, where is the primary document that the military would actively support, not support statehood or be against statehood? But, you know, it's probably logical. You know, I just really don't know.
If you've got that document, John Klo wants you to get in touch. He's now retired and lives in Anchorage. If Eisenhower had economic concerns about statehood, so did a lot of other people. Many just couldn't see how the new state government would pay its costs, and business interests worried that their tax burden would increase heavily. 15 years before statehood passed, the Juneau Chamber of Commerce Legislative Committee summed up its opposition. Here, excerpts are read by actor Dick Reichman.
The costs would all continue under statehood. In addition, we would necessarily have to set up state courts. The cost of four courts based on actual district court cost records would be $500,000 per year. This represents the cost of the courts, including all operations, marshals, commissioner, operation of jails, etc. It is certain that the costs of administering a state government would greatly exceed the cost of the territorial administration, and it is impossible to see at this time any additional sources of revenue which would be available to the people of Alaska if it were made a state. If the state took over complete control of the fisheries, it would not affect the revenue from the fisheries, which now go entirely to the territory, but it would require additional appropriations from such funds as the state was able to raise by taxation, amounting to nearly $700,000 a year.
Soon after that report was made, the chamber reversed its opinion and sided with statehood. But not everyone was convinced so easily, and some of them favored an alternative to immediate statehood. Jessica Cochran has more.
Alaska Communications Service veteran Lee Jordan recalls one of his neighbors' resistance to becoming a state. He still drives by the reminder on a regular basis.
There's a road in Birchwood that's named Statehood Drive, and the friend of ours who lived there and put the road in said he didn't vote for statehood. He was opposed to it because we couldn't afford it. And he thought it was going to be just like that road, all mired down in mud, and you'd get stuck and couldn't get out of it.
That concern about the expense of statehood caused some to favor an alternative, becoming a commonwealth like Puerto Rico is today.
Well, it was just an easier step. We didn't have any expenses.
That's Petersburg fisherman John Enge. He recalls making a choice between statehood and commonwealth. And he's not the only one. Here's Eldon Galear, who came to Alaska in the 1940s as a merchant marine.
There was a lot of pros and cons, you know, about statehood or commonwealth. And if I remember right, you could mark either one on the ballot. I'm not sure about that anymore. It's been too many years ago. But I know after reading what I did and whatnot, I went for the commonwealth. I didn't go for statehood. To me, at that time, the people would have better control over their taxation. That was one reason I went for it.
It turns out Galear and Enge aren't remembering quite right. Alaskans never had the choice to vote for Commonwealth status, but it was often discussed. And historian Steve Haycox says not all the arguments were purely economic.
There were some pretty interesting arguments against statehood. Jay Hammond, for example, opposed statehood on the grounds that it would bring in new population, new economic development, and would ruin the character of the state and put its environmental crown jewels, if you will, in jeopardy. And I think that Commonwealth status would have been seen as a kind of lesser status that might have been less attractive to potential new settlers than statehood would be. I think that's probably the explanation.
But Haycox says it was clear the majority of Alaskans wouldn't settle for Commonwealth status.
Commonwealth status is not much different than territorial status. It still would leave the federal government essentially in control of the territory. It might elevate the prestige, I suppose, of whoever the territory's advocate might be. Alaska, of course, had an elected congressional delegate, non-voting delegate. Certainly nothing approaching statehood, certainly.
Haycox says only those who wanted Alaska to be frozen in time wanted continued territorial status, and he doesn't know of other alternatives that were seriously considered. In any case, after Congress approved the Alaska Statehood Bill, Alaskans were asked only to accept or reject the terms of that bill, not about alternatives. That's a vote the Alaskan Independence Party still hopes to see someday. According to its website, the party's goal is to allow Alaskans, quote, the choice they were entitled to in 1958, one choice from among the following four alternatives: one, remain a territory; two, become a separate and independent nation; three, accept Commonwealth status; or four, become a state, end quote. But of course, Alaska is a state now, for better or for worse. And as for that muddy old statehood road, Lee Jordan says things are looking up. It's in much better shape these days. For AK, I'm Jessica Cochran.
After the break, we'll hear about some political factors that played into statehood. But popular culture played a role in promoting Alaska statehood, too. In March of 1958, shortly before the U.S. House took up the latest version of a statehood bill, Edna Ferber's book Ice Palace was published. Ferber has been described as the most popular novelist of the time, and one critic described the bestseller as a love letter in fiction form to Alaska. It was unabashedly pro-statehood, pitting two men against each other, one a businessman who aligns with outside interests opposed to statehood, the other a writer and newspaper publisher active in promoting statehood. The book was later made into a movie, filmed in Petersburg, starring starring Richard Burton and Robert Ryan. While the plot varies slightly from the novel, the themes remain. In this clip, a young Thor Storm rails against outside cannery owners.
Everybody who comes to Alaska grabs what he can and leaves, whether it's gold or fish or furs. They rush in here like a pack of hungry wolves, gorge themselves and rush out again, and nobody puts anything back.
Later in the film, the statehood question is addressed directly by businessman Zeb Kennedy at a congressional field hearing on statehood.
Mr. Kennedy, our records show there's been quite an increase in revenue up here over the past several years.
That's all due to the Army and the Air Force. Without them, Alaska's so-called prosperity would collapse overnight.
Let him give the facts to support that statement.
It's all very well for the fanatics to shoot their mouths off, but who's going to foot the bill? Statehood can only mean a bigger and bigger tax load for all the people until it finally breaks their backs. That's a lie.
Ferber did travel to Alaska several times to research the book. Historian Mary Manguso says Zeb Kennedy's character is based on Austin Cap Lathrop of Fairbanks, and another character on Eva McGowan, the official hostess of Fairbanks. Manguso says the Ice Palace, a tall glass building at the center of the fictional town of Baranoff, had its roots in reality, too.
The Ice Palace itself was the Northward Building in Fairbanks, which, of course, is not made out of glass. It's made out of corrugated metal. But she supposedly saw it from the campus of UAF, and the sun was on it, and it was gleaming kind of pinkish in the sun, and this inspired her to create the Ice Palace.
Manguso says she's heard a story that someone bought a copy of the book for each U.S. senator and representative.
I don't know whether it's true, and I don't know if any of them read it. I've never come across anything by anybody who said, I voted for statehood because I read Edna Ferber's Ice Palace. But it certainly presented a very sympathetic view of the statehood movement.
Territorial Governor and Alaska Senator Ernest Greening did give Ferber some credit for statehood passing. The two kept in touch while she was writing, and in his account of the battle for statehood, he calls the book's publication an unexpected break for the statehood movement. And he says he has no doubt that it changed quite a few votes in Congress. Coming up, why statehood may have rested on how much people liked one particular guy. You're listening to a special Statehood Anniversary edition of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Steve Heimel. After 42 years of trying, Alaskans' dreams of becoming a state began to take shape in the spring of 1958. Statehood bills had been considered in Congress for at least a decade. Testimony had been taken, but the bills had all languished. Still, statehood proponents geared up again, and in May, the latest version of the Alaska Statehood Bill was debated on the House floor. It took parliamentary maneuvers, 6 days of debate, and a lot of persuasion. Territorial Governor Mike Stepovich says advocates argued that after 91 years as a territory, Alaska was overdue for the same status other states had.
They kind of felt a little sorry, in a way, that we didn't have representation, although we had a delegate, Bob Bartlett, down there. But he couldn't vote on any matters or anything. And also that we didn't have senators and be on equal footing.
The bill passed the House on May 28th and was taken up in the Senate a month later. Senator Ted Stevens was working for the Interior Department at the time. He says statehood proponents fought hard to kill any Senate amendments to the bill. They worried if the bill had to go back to a House-Senate conference committee, it would get bogged down. Then, on June 30th, the Senate voted 64-20 in favor of statehood.
We all went to the little chapel in the Capitol and had a little meeting there with Governor Stepovich and then to become Governor Egan, Bob Bartlett, Ernest Greening. We were all there and just sort of had a little prayer meeting.
In those days of debate leading up to the votes, plenty of issues were raised. There were those same economic concerns some Alaskans had, that the state couldn't support itself, and the fear that the Alaska delegation would dilute the vote of other more populous states. Southern legislators didn't want to tip the balance on a Civil Rights Act in the Senate. But by some accounts, the final decision on how to vote rested not on reasoned arguments or political strategy, but on personality. Ann Sutton explains.
There were lots of arguments, and they were all over the map. Take George Malone, the conservative senator from Nevada. In 1958, he voiced this concern to television reporter Ed Murrow about allowing non-contiguous areas into the Union and changing the quote-unquote complexion of the U.S. Senate.
So you get two senators from Alaska, then you get two from Hawaii, then Puerto Rico comes in, no excuse, and six. You take Formosa, why not? There's as many Chinese in Hawaii as there is in Formosa.
Then you had some Texans worried about losing their stature as the biggest state, which didn't stop Jim Wright from supporting statehood. In a recent interview, the Texas Democrat and war veteran said he argued the nation should honor the rights of those who served in wartime.
By allowing them to vote and participate fully as a citizen in the country. And I believe that then, and I believe it now.
But while Congress batted the issue around for years, Wright heard from only a few disgruntled constituents. And former University of Alaska Fairbanks professor and author John Whitehead says, based on his interviews with lawmakers, statehood never seemed to be a pressing issue with their public.
They really had very little correspondence or constituent support one way or another, so it tended to be in many cases a personal choice of those representatives based on whether they liked the people who came to visit them about from Alaska and Hawaii, and just whether they thought it was important.
When it came to likability, just about everyone agreed that Alaska had a gold mine in Bob Bartlett, for 14 years the territory's lone and voteless delegate to Congress. A Fairbanks boy from a mining family, Bartlett had been a reporter at the Daily News Miner and the federal secretary to Alaska. Bartlett had a sharp mind, a keen sense of humor, and was just the nicest guy, says Mary Nordale, an old family friend who worked for Bartlett in the 1960s.
His approach to legislation was to persuade people rather than blast them with a whole bunch of razzmatazz. His personality was one that would work well with people, and the more they got to know him, the more they got to trust him.
Others have said that because he was a voteless delegate, He never enraged anybody by voting against their pet proposal.
Whitehead says Bartlett could write and promote his own bills, and he did so with such prowess that he had more legislation pass into law than any other congressman. But Congress was a tough nut to crack when it came to the Statehood Act, and Bartlett had reinforcements, like Ernest Greening, the territorial governor of Alaska for 14 years. A New Yorker with a Harvard medical degree who'd been a muckraker journalist and a prominent expert in Latin American affairs, Greening could dazzle, says Juno economist George Rogers.
He was brilliant. He could stand up on his feet and deliver whole speeches, you know, beautiful speeches without any preparation. Interesting to see these two men working on the same thing and being very effective in their own fields, in their own way.
Meanwhile, newspaper publisher Bob Atwood and construction mogul Wally Hickel were familiar faces in D.C., working on balky Republicans. And after the Constitutional Convention, statehood boosters hatched the Tennessee Plan, in which Greening, Bill Egan, the Valdez shopkeeper who would become the state's first governor, and frontier lawyer Ralph Rivers all went to D.C. as a kind of shadow congressional delegation. The idea was to convince Congress they could do the real job if given half a chance. Still, it was a long haul from the time the first statehood bill was introduced. A budding civil rights movement played into it, and Hawaii's statehood bill was critical as well. Bringing both in at the same time would, for the near term at least, preserve the political balance in Congress. But even Bartlett and Greening were stumped by some arguments. Nevada's George Malone suggested they wait until Alaska was contiguous.
But sometime you may take all of the Western Hemisphere in one contiguous group. That's about the size of it. If we took Canada, we can take Alaska.
Malone never did vote for Alaska's statehood. For AK, I'm Ann Sutton.
At the same time George Malone was interviewed for Ed Murrow's television special, Homesteaders Rusty and Larry Lancashire also appeared.
Put it this way, how would you like to be sitting right in the middle of Illinois, having Illinois a territory, and have to have Washington tell you what to do all the time? It's not that we're particularly complaining about Washington, but we're Americans, we would like to control our own affairs.
And as for the costs?
I like to compare it with matrimony. If everybody waited until they could afford to get married before they got married, there'd be very few of them get married. You just got to knuckle down to your job and do it.
Murrow said then that it was homesteaders who would give Alaska its strength, as they had in other territories that became states. And homesteaders certainly were a strong bunch. The image of the rustic, fur-clad Alaskan mushing a dog team down frigid winter trails is a true one up to a point. But after World War II, airplanes came into common use, and many a wartime pilot used aviation skills to blaze a new kind of trail to remote federal homesteads in Alaska. Frank and Marge Mullen were a young couple from Chicago who headed up here to stake a claim on the Kenai Peninsula, right about where the city of Soldotna stands today. Frank Mullen is now deceased, but AK's Ellen Lockyer visited with 88-year-old Marge Mullen on the original homestead site, where she still lives today.
Seagulls swoop over the turquoise-colored waters of the Kenai River. They are looking to snag jumping silver salmon on a warm August day.
There's some action right there, isn't there? I don't think there's a fisherman there either.
At present, a city park and its boardwalk parallel the riverbank. But in 1947, Marge and Frank Mullen were the first homesteaders to set foot on the claim bordering the Kenai, where Soldotna Creek joins the river. Frank Mullen was a bomber pilot who saw action in England. When he returned to Chicago, Marge and he married, then bought a beat-up old plane of their own.
A little two-seater airplane, a Stinson 105, from a farmer in Iowa, and packed not very much. It was kind of going like backpackers in this little plane.
Inspired by two lines they spotted in a Chicago paper advertising a veteran's preference for federal homesteads, they flew to Alaska, using the new Alaska Highway below as a compass to Anchorage.
We stopped a couple of places in Canada at air bases. We were in radio contact, but we'd land there, and then people would come over and talk to us and ask us what we were doing on this military base. And after we told them our story, they'd gas us up and put us up for the night even.
At age 27, Marge already had two children when she and Frank left Anchorage on the Alaska Railroad to stake their Kenai claim.
Then we got off at Moose Pass. We both had backpacks. And walking down away from the railroad station, we hadn't gone very far when a man in a little Chevy of some kind picked us up. He was headed for Hope, so we went to about mile 38 with him.
Then they walked a distance of some 60 miles along a dirt track left by equipment used to clear the route for the new Sterling Highway.
It wasn't a road. The highway department had taken old World War II equipment off over the beaches in Kenai and headed up to a hidden lake. It was a very sandy track. They weren't doing anything about it except getting their equipment up. They were going to start from that east end and come this way.
They passed through land terribly scarred by a forest fire.
The whole forest by this time looked like the back door to hell. It was all standing, all very blackened. The soil was burnt. Even the soil itself was burnt down to the sand. When I'd hold on to a tree going down a hill or something, it had come right with me.
And when they reached the Kenai homesteads, they encountered a few hardy homesteaders like themselves.
We went on to where we had looked on the map to the Kenai River, where Soldotna Creek flows into the Kenai River.
Staking the claim was relatively uncomplicated. They found their corners and put a note in a coffee can and nailed it to a tree.
We nailed it up
you
there.
Nailed it. Okay.
Yeah, so if somebody else come along there would know that we had at least been there. We put our foot on the ground and we were headed for the land office with our $10.
Then they pressed on to the village of Kenai.
The low spot where The Kenai Spur Road takes off was kind of a dish. It looked like chocolate pudding at that time from the rains. But we did walk down to the mouth of Soldotna Creek and dropped our packs for a while and had a stick and a fish hook, and we caught a couple trout for a meal there.
When they got to Kenai, a friend picked them up in their own plane, and they all flew back to Anchorage. Later on, Marge and the children stayed in the Soldotna cabin they built while her husband worked in Anchorage.
I was chinking the cabin. I'd put moss in there, and then I'd chink the cracks and have to get little tiny spruce poles to keep the chinking in because this wasn't a very good tight cabin, that's for sure.
Homesteading had rules, and one was that the woman, if there was a woman, had to live on the claim. The man could go and work somewhere else. The Homestead Act was passed by Congress in 1862, and the Mullinses had inherited the spunk of the pioneers who settled the continental U.S. West 80 years before. Only they had swapped Conestoga wagon wheels for airplane wings. Frank Mullen would fly in on weekends.
Sometimes our cabin on Saturday night would be wall-to-wall sleeping bags, you know. Other people with airplanes, they would come down, and they used to get the greatest, biggest rainbow trout out of Soldotna Creek. Trout that would be 34 and 36 inches long, or just humongous.
Homesteaders like Marge Mullen may or may not have had a vision of the future Alaska. The statehood debate came along a dozen years after the Mullinses staked their claim.
I met Tony Diamond and Bob Bartlett and Greening, all those people in Chicago. We never would have been that close to our politicians, and the big push was on for statehood. I think the oil exploration and find in Swanson River kind of pushed that along. But then we voted about 75% in favor of statehood.
Marge eventually had two more children. All of them grew up on the homestead, and three still live on the Kenai Peninsula. Now shopping centers and traffic congestion clog the highway intersection that once looked like chocolate pudding. Soldotna's urban sprawl obliterates any whiff of the pioneer lifestyle as Burger Drive-Ins and Fred Meyer's compete for customers. But up a quiet lane, not far from the town's center, a little ranch house sits by the Kenai River, and seagulls and eagles wheel overhead, just like they used to 60 years ago. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
We'll leave you today with excerpts from the Juno Symphony Orchestra's performance of An Alaskan Symphony. Composer Wilson Sawyer wrote the symphony in 1945. Its world premiere was broadcast across the country, and then-territorial governor Ernest Greening spoke between two of the movements about the territory of Alaska and the statehood movement. He asked for a copy of the score, and ever since it's been stored in the state archives. The symphony was performed one more time in 1975, and Sawyer was inspired to revise it. The Juno Symphony's June performance was the first for the revised version. The symphony incorporates the Robert Service poem Song of the Yukon about the gold rush days. Violinist Bob King says it also incorporates Sawyer's musical interpretation of Alaska.
There are parts in there where you will hear his impression, I believe, of the Aurora Borealis, the northern lights. There's the whole fourth movement has this sort of shimmery, wavy pattern to it that repeats and repeats. In the third movement, where the Robert Service comes in, there's one part called the summer, and he uses a particular technique with the violins and the like, which really does sound like mosquitoes. And everybody in the audience immediately got that. And so he writes in little sections like that. He talks about this work as not being a programmatic work. It doesn't, you know, tell a specific story. But it involves this imagery that he got from, as he put it, from his understanding of the history and the culture and the like of Alaska.
King says Sawyer had been hired to write a musical score for an ice show called the Alaska Stampede. He suspects that was his inspiration to write a more serious work about Alaska. At the time, many composers were writing grand, big works designed to evoke the American West.
It's very much a period work. It's very much a work from the 1940s. But it has, because of that, it's kind of unique. And it fits in with, it's at a time when the statehood movement was really accelerating and the push towards statehood was underway. And this is one man's musical impressions of all of that. I think it's worthy of a listen. And I'd hope that other Alaskan symphonies may pick it up and give it a try.
And that's AK for this week. We had help today from Ann Sutton in Juneau, Johanna Urich in Anchorage, and AK's Ellen Lockyer on the Kenai Peninsula. Our theme music is by Bamua. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org. And while you're there, browse through our archives, check out some photos, or send an email to let us know how we're doing. You can also email us directly at ak@aprn.org. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. Jessica Cochran is our senior producer. Our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Steve Heimel. AK will be back next week with a new show called The Best of Summer. And I'll be back next month with another Statehood Anniversary special. Thanks for joining us.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.